You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it is America's Talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm George Cedarquist. Remember me? Gonna get to that in a second. We kick off Women's History Month with three of our favorite ladies and three of our favorite interviews. Director Francesca Zambello, the Queen of the Night, soprano Catherine Lewick, and mezzo-soprano Isabel Leonard. Hey, make sure you subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, click follow, Apple Podcasts, hit that plus sign. Send us a voice memo or even just email us your hot takes, mailbag@operaboxscore.com. You can even just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com. You're going to get your voice heard live on the podcast. And hey, look, however you contribute, you're going to get that OBS beer coaster, the OBS lapel pin, and the number one OBS fan foam finger in Bears orange and blue. It's absolutely adorable. You get all that stuff just for sharing your own hot take, however short or long your thoughts are. A little bit of sports before we get down to it. Okay, it is March. It is hockey season right now. I know the association, the NBA, is playing. I'm not a huge basketball fan. We haven't made it to college basketball and March Madness yet. That will be coming down the pike for us on the show. College football is over. The NFL is over. If you are a hockey fan like me, this is the sweet spot. This is the dream. Watching the Red Wings, my team, play, ascending in the rankings. I'm finally playing a little bit more hockey myself. Essentially, anything we can do to delay the horrors of opening day and baseball season, I will take. Let's talk some opera.
Huddle up. Let's go inside the huddle.
Just after Thanksgiving of 2023, director and intendant and Francesca Zambello was actually in Chicago working on a production of Shostakovich's The Nose at Chicago Opera Theater. And we went inside the huddle to talk about that very piece.
So our guest today is none other than Francesca Zambello. Welcome to Opera Box Score. I have to say that your name came into my consciousness as a gay man in the late 90s because I heard about this Iphigenie in Glimmerglass, which is one of your major roles that you've had in your career. You know, I've also heard that you are really into audiences and you really have studied audiences. And you get in the audience's face and you try to figure out, what do you guys want? What do you need? How are you going to come to the opera? And I feel like the Iphigenie is the thing that got my attention, even though I didn't see it. But it felt like, okay, she understands who's coming to the opera. She's going to give them something that they won't forget. And it sort of launched this whole bear hunks era. And I mean, let's just be clear. I mean, like, a lot of gay men go to opera. was that what your strategy was, or just like, no, Nathan's a beautiful guy, he can do this, you know?
Well, so that was in 97. That was my debut at Glimmerglass, and then it went on to City Opera, The Late Lamented, and it was, you know, I think it's two things you mentioned. You know, yes, I did think it's a Greek drama. It wasn't even, you know, thinking, oh my God, Nathan and Bill Burden are incredibly attractive, you know, young, the generation of, you know, emerging opera singers who are great singers, actors, and have amazing physicality, something that we sometimes take for granted today with a lot of singers. But so I said, you know, I wanted to do a production that was like the Greeks. And I was like, The Greeks men wore diapers, basically. And I told them that about 8 months before. And I said, this is the costume. Can we go with it? I asked them and they said yes. And I said, do you think you could work towards status of making me believe that you had been sailing around the Aegean in very few clothes. And it will also be very physical, because the love story of Iphigenia and Tauride is, of course, the sister. She loves her brother, Orest. But, of course, Orest loves his best friend, Pylades, and vice versa. And so I said it's also a Greek story, a love story between the two men. And now we call it a bromance. Mm-hmm. And so I just, with Nathan, I didn't, you know, the term of barahunks, I sort of just think I said it, and then it suddenly hit the internet as the internet was just getting going. And now I don't know. I mean, a lot of people think that that's inappropriate. And so I'm like, you know, because we just have to be cautious how we describe people's physicality now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I agree with you. And I say it because I know a lot of these people. Nathan, I've interviewed him for a couple of times. He's very comfortable talking about it. And, you know, we don't want to objectify people, but, you know, it was a moment in opera, and it continues to still have influence in, you know, that era in opera, you know, in how singers prepare. I mean, you look at a role like Dead Man Walking now, you can't even think about singing that role unless you're willing to do whatever, 20 pushups on stage.
We have to do 20 full body pushups. Yeah. So, yes, I mean, for me, the genesis of that was really the story and the of Greek men. And of course, you know, even then, I'm no fool. You know, a lot of gay men love opera. Gay women do, too. And I am someone who, when you mention this, I do believe it in the audience. I believe that there's a difference, I think, between like saying, oh, let's cater to the audience. But why should we not try to make our audiences happy and enjoy what they're seeing, because we want them to come back. I mean, it's as simple as that. And of course, opera is a lot of micro audiences. You know, there is a gay audience. There is what we call a legacy audience of people who are, you know, of a certain age. There's a great new audience emerging, which is people who are recently retired, the baby boomers who never had time to go, who are falling in love with opera. There is millennials, there are Gen X, but each of them, in a way, there are overlaps, I've learned, of things they like. But also sometimes you just really got to focus on specific groups when you're marketing or creating, you know, your show. And I speak that way as a director, but also as a producer of many, many productions, and where I will often try to steer a production team in a certain direction, or give them notes that I think, you know, might make a better experience for the audience.
Even though I'm a Gen Xer, I had a very traditional introduction to opera. I was mentored the way it used to be when one gay generation taught the younger gay generation how to appreciate the finer things in life. And, you know, that generation all died because of AIDS. And so we did lose, I think, you know, a lot of mentors. And that's why I blame my generation of gays as not being interested in certain aspects of what has used to be our culture in the gay community. But setting gay people aside, I was talking about how you literally go into the audiences and you want to meet them and talk to them. And there's this article that Anthony Tomasini wrote about you when you had concluded your tenure at Glimmerglass, which I'll link to in the podcast so people can read that. But it also applies to your initiatives in the DEI space. And these are initiatives that you were doing even before DEI was like a word. Can you talk about that as a strategy, like going back to your time at Glimmerglass and your work at WNO and just trying to think about how to bring in different audiences?
Well, for me, I think, you know, everything that I have worked on, particularly in like leadership position of management, which is now 13 years between Glimmerglass and then 11 years at WNO, my stated goal in both places, which I publicly stated, was that at least a third, if not a half of our casting must not be white. We didn't have the term BIPOC when I was getting going. Mm-hmm. And that at least 50% of the creative team, you know, composer, librettist, or conductor, director, designers must be not white men. So I pretty much, I practiced that to the letter in both companies and still do. And of course now, you know, DEI has made it more popular and more, of course, important than other companies that followed suit. And I think in a way it was embedded in me early on as a director, starting in the freelance circuit, you know, really, you know, in the mid 80s. And of course, being a woman, you know, I was facing my own prejudices, my own, you know, discrimination, you know, a lot. Of course, you know, then of course, added discrimination if you came out, particularly for women, it was harder. But I saw, you know, a lot of colleagues, you know, particularly Black singers, particularly, who I saw like not getting cast in roles that I thought like, well, boy, I would have cast them. So when I got in a position, even as a director by the 90s, where I could sit in the casting meetings, because that's how it happens. You're in the casting meeting with the head of a company, sometimes with the conductor, you know, with the administrator, the chief administrator. And I would really try to pitch singers that there was some diversity in the casting. So, and I was like, we can't ever expect audiences to come if they don't see themselves on stage. It's as simple as that. We can't expect audiences to pay attention if you don't put a picture, a big picture of a woman as a conductor out there, or if you don't see them bow. I mean, those are the things that make, excuse me, that make audiences pay attention. So I said, not only am I preaching this philosophically, but I think it's important that we that we do this, because this is what our society is. If we want this art form to survive. And believe me, when I was saying things like that early on, there was a lot of pushback. I heard a lot of things I would never repeat in an interview that were extremely disheartening and dispiriting and upsetting, sexist and racist. I just phenomenally so.
Well, it still exists, unfortunately.
Yes, of course it exists, but we are doing marginally better in a lot of ways. And this was also at a time before we even thought not just about casting and hiring of creative teams, but also of topics. We were not using opera in the way that in many ways that its initial tradition was, that it was a social and political voice. And that's something that really has come to the forefront, especially in American works in the last decade. And the other, I'd have to say, underrepresented group, so to speak, that I used to make a lot of noises about and still do, is youth and children and youth. I said, like, why are we doing operas that we're saying are family operas and we don't have like whole families in them and children? And so I've commissioned a number of works that are not like kid operas, but they have kids in them, or there's a kid's chorus. I just think, you know, the action of seeing the person on stage brings together more in the audience. So for me, it's sort of been a multilateral quest.
And the formula has always existed. I mean, as much as people might like groan about it, when the children's chorus comes out in Carmen, it's always such a delight. Like, people just get so excited to see their whatever, their little kid up on stage, or like a kid they recognize. And like, it's just a 2 minutes of just joy for everybody, you know? So why not do it more often? Probably because it's expensive and it's late and you need childcare.
Well, what's harder, to be truthful, is operas like Tannhäuser, where the kids appear in the last 15 minutes of the opera. But it's more, I don't know, I've worked on commissions or commissioned, you know, things like, you know, The Little Prince, The Odyssey, Robin Hood, there's probably been about we did operas with Carlos Simon and Mo Willem at the Kennedy Center, Slopera. We put things out on trucks during the pandemic so families could see and hear opera. So for me, that's been sort of a parallel quest with equity in hiring across the board.
And speaking of children, a common theme we have running through our show over these past years is talking about being in the opera industry and being a parent. And we often poll our guests when they're willing to talk about it. You know, what are the organizations that thought about your status as a parent and which organizations supported you? And I would say most people, when they were forced to come up with a name, your name came up as being somebody who thinks comprehensively about how to support artists. When did that start for you? When did you understand that, oh, in order to get this singer, I need to like make sure there's somebody around that can watch their kid?
Well, I'm so touched to hear that. Thank you. I think, you know, living life a lot on the road, you know, most people's jobs are on the road unless they have a, let's say, a fest contract in Germany. And I've always thought it's really important, again, a sort of global view. It's important as an artist to have a personal life. I think that having a personal life makes you a better artist. Not everybody agrees with that, but I think we have to support that. And I do think, you know, you see, I guess I watched a lot of women in their 30s drop out of the profession because they wanted to have children and there was no support for it while they were pursuing a career. So therefore, it was suddenly like all the men were doing much better going into their 40s. And we were suddenly saying, okay, where's the next generation of, you know, young sopranos and mezzos? We'll just pair them. And I realized that we weren't supporting the family situation, particularly for women, enough. And that's not to say that there aren't plenty of men who have done their share of letting their wife go out and be on the road. And I never would presume otherwise. But there was just a demographic about that. And so I have always tried to do things like, you know, make sure that the holiday breaks, that we leave early enough and come back late enough. Make sure that somebody, if they're coming and they're bringing their nanny, if they can afford a nanny, you know, then, you know, making sure we work around their schedule, making sure that if they can't afford a nanny, that we find a way to do rehearsals where, you know, their kids can be doing something else. I'm always big on like, give them all the information, like certainly at WNO and Glimmerglass, on where there are childcare centers, where there are camps, where there's things that kids can do, because keeping kids busy as a parent is the most important thing that you can do. And so I think for me, it's just been a matter of concern. It's not just the kid thing, but respecting the whole picture for artists. Because, you know, again, it's a no-brainer. But if somebody is happy and not worried about where is their child, they will sing better. And it's my goal, of course, that they sing better or act better. And so I think it's just something that I've been attuned to, not just for performers, but also for the whole staff. And I think, you know, of course, now we're much more conscious of, you know, life work balance, but I've been doing this forever and been just tried to be really in tune to it. Look, if it was the kind of thing where I knew if the soprano came 3 days later, 3 days late for rehearsal, she would see her kids' show in school and her own mother would be there to take her kid, whatever, then I'd be like, just let it happen. Cause then they're going to show up and they're going to feel like, okay, now I can focus and do a good job. And, you know, we don't live in a country. It's interesting when you work in Scandinavian countries, for example, you rehearse in the morning, like until 2 o'clock, because everyone goes home to take care of their kids then. And then you rehearse like 8 to 11 in the evening, which can be tiring, but it's usually after kids have gone to bed. So anyway, so that's my kid thing. And yes, I am a parent. And yes, I know how important it is. And yes, I've been, just like other parents, done many a midnight train, an overnight flight, getting up at 4 a.m. to drive somewhere to make sure I was there to make pancakes for breakfast. That's part of the game. But I just tried to make it easier for people.
Well, you are currently working with one of the most incredible women that I think is in our industry right now, Lydia Yankovskaya. I don't know if you had met her before you arrived at Chicago Opera Theater, but she's mind-blowing in what she's able to do and how dedicated she is to her work, and also clearly what a great mother she is. At the same time, it's like, how does she do it all?
Well, I have never directed something that Lydia conducted, but I did hire her very early in her career to conduct at Washington National Opera. She's conducted there a couple of times, and then I had her at Glimmerglass twice to conduct. So I've worked with her a lot, but only as a producer, not as a director. And yes, I've absolutely have enormous respect for her and her beautiful children and her lovely husband, who is an attorney, and I am married to a trial lawyer. So I so I understand their schedules as well. And I think, you know, just here now working at Chicago Opera Theater with Lydia conducting the nose and directing the nose, it's just been a phenomenally joyful experience so far.
So the nose, that's why we're talking today, because you are in Chicago. The nose opens on December 8th. And it's not an opera many people know about. And I wonder if the decision to choose this opera has something to do with our current political climate, or is it just that it's a work that needs to be heard, or is it a little bit of A and a little bit of B? From your perspective, why program the nose?
Well, Lydia wanted to program it actually before the pandemic, and we spoke about it. So it's been in her conscience, obviously, for some time, and then it finally came together. And I think that COT probably thought a lot about programming a Shostakovich opera. However, for any people who know a bit of his history, you know, he was an incredible dissident. He was anti-government. I mean, everything that Shostakovich wrote symphonically and in the opera world, piano pieces, they all have an undercurrent of defiance. And defiance against the system. And for him, it was the Soviet system. So I think it's so appropriate to be doing this now, where it's so much a story based on the Gogol short story of the same name that is really about the little person being squashed by the system and the superficiality of many parts of class ranking. And so I think that those issues are ever present, you know, globally, but also very much clearly right now, as you know, we're in this just terrible period of history. And so I think that's a big part of this story. But also I want to say Shostakovich uses absurdism and satire. And that's, you know, the piece is light, like you laugh a lot. It's a funny ha-ha, and which I think is also a good thing right now.
Is there something about this particular cast or production that you feel will entice people to check it out?
Well, I think the cast is phenomenal, led by Alexei Bogdanov, who I know has sung here a lot. And then Curtis Bannister is the nose. And the thing that I have loved working here is that almost all of the cast, barring just a couple of people, are from Chicago. And Chicago has a really deep pool of superb musicians and vocalists. And I know that from working at the Lyric a number of times. And so for me, this experience has been phenomenal with our cast of 36. It's a big cast. And every person plays like five roles. Except for the nose and Alexei, who's the character who he loses his nose because the idiot barber played by Wilbur Pauly mistakenly shaves off his nose. But the nose, of course, is a symbol really of someone who is insignificant and rises to power. And that's sort of part of the whole absurdism of this piece. So for me, the great thing about doing it has been getting to know so many Chicago performers who I didn't know before. And so to me, that's another great reason to see the piece, is just this rainbow of amazing talent here.
Well, that did it for me. I mean, you're right about Chicago Opera Theater. I think that was one of Lydia's initiatives when she came, is to make the company more Chicago-centric. And a lot of those people on stage are literally my colleagues. And I know when they're all at a rehearsal, it's like, oh, that's because they're in the nose. That's why I can't hang out with those people. And I understand that there's also a choreographer involved in this production.
One of the amazing things about Shostakovich's score was he wrote many entracts, even like a 4-minute percussion entract, which are clearly invitations to dance and movement. And so I have been collaborating with Kia Smith of Chicago South Dance and her amazing troupe of young dancers who have brought a sort of style of contemporary choreography as well as, I would say, sort of Soviet constructivist movement into the story. And so it's been a joy to collaborate with her, as well as other Chicago artist Marcus Doshi, who is the set and lighting designer, who is part of the Northwestern faculty. So I brought on board, not just in terms of working with all these great performers, but also Chicago creative teams to work together.
Francesca Zambello, it has been so amazing to meet you. I hope we can talk again. Thanks for coming to Opera Box Score.
Thank you so much for having me, Oliver.
Francesca Zambello inside the huddle with us just after Thanksgiving in November 2023. Going back further in time, we're actually into 2022 now. This is our October 10th show. The Queen of the Night, Catherine Lewick, was in town. She was at that time on a 6-city season tour, which included a stop to sing in a production of Count Ori with our continual friend of the show, but also rival of our fantasy football team with Philadelphia Opera. That would be Larry Brownlee. That show at the end of October. Here's what we talked about.
So if you have heard The Queen of the Night and The Magic Flute in the past couple of years, you probably have heard our guest today, Catherine Lewick. That was from Aix-en-Provence in 2014. And she doesn't just sing the F. She sort of like, you know, has like a little coffee break up there. And it's insane. I heard Catherine sing Queen of the Night in Chicago. I forget when it was, 2018 or something, 2017. And I was like, no way. I have never heard this sung this well and this confidently. And then you backed it up with a Mozart Mass in C minor with Music of the Broke. And, you know, I was expecting, well, they got an opera singer to sing this thing. It's like, okay, let's see how she does, you know? And it was poised. It was elegant. It had chest voice, well mixed. It was so in tune and it was phrased like, holy F, this is an incredible singer. So with that, welcome to Opera Box Score. Such a huge fan. And it's not the first time that your name has come up on the show and we'll talk about why, but at any rate, welcome.
Thank you guys. You make me feel so good about myself right off the bat.
So do you want to just like talk a little bit about Queen of the Night and what that role it has been for you? And are you ready to move on, or are you still going to keep it in the repertoire?
Oh my gosh, you're going to frighten people.
It is October. Yeah, I mean, it's spooky season.
I know, right? It's Halloween. Yeah, I mean, Queen has been kind of a really fun vehicle for me for a number of reasons. I mean, I'm a really kind of dramatic person anyway, so it's cathartic in that way to sing sort of the Disney villainess. Although, I mean, the wonderful thing about Queen is that over the however many productions I've done, and like, you know, my agent tells me I've sung like over 300 performances. I don't know if I believe her or not, but it is something. It is something like that. And it's actually, for it only being like a 12-minute role, it's always kind of crazy to me how different it can feel from production to production. So it, I can't really say that I have tired of it, because I also feel like it's just been such an opportunity that it has brought me all over the world to so many different houses and introduced me to so many different people. And I've made so many friends while singing the production. So I'm not necessarily like tired of Queen, but I really also owe that, I think, to my agent, who's also a really wonderful friend of mine, Vanessa Yuzan. You know, because from the very beginning, when we were first working together, which was, oh my gosh, over 10 years ago, I was like, I don't always want to sing Queen of the Night. And she's like, I don't want you to always sing Queen of the Night. You're such a flexible artist and you have so much to give. And she saw that about me from the very beginning. And because of that, our partnership has always had this flavor of, okay, well, what are the couple of queens that I'm going to take this season? And what else are we going to put in there? What other opportunities do we have to, you know, have things in between queens that, you know, also really fulfill me as an artist? So, you know, I think that if I had been singing only Queen for the last 10 years, which I'm sure a lot of people out there feel like I have only been singing Queen, but that really is not the case. I've done so many other interesting things. And so I haven't really totally tired of it, but yeah, I feel like I'm kind of mentally coming to that point where there is no official plan to give up Queen in the near future, but just the other things that I'm starting to be offered are much more exciting to me. I just accepted my first Alcina, which I'm super, super excited about. You know, in this season, I'm doing the four heroines from Hoffman.
And oh, man.
I'm doing Montori in Chicago, and I'm singing a Lucia in Nice. So just, I'm getting sort of, and there's some more Violetas on the horizon. So those things just kind of feel like I'm graduating into a part of my career where I can pick and choose a little bit more. And it's just a little more appetizing to me to do lots of different things and some more roles that have a lot more meat in them.
There is something about Mozart singing where a lot of people get in their heads and they think, oh, I have to be, you know, rhythmically perfect. I have to have, you know, this instrumental quality to the voice. It's got to be articulated clean, intonation, obviously. And that seems to be like naturally what you do. So if you are graduating to, for lack of a better word, more romantic repertoire, does that mean that you're allowing the voice to take up more fluff, you know, to take up more warmth?
Be messy. Oh my gosh.
Or you've been holding back when you're singing Mozart?
No, I don't think that I necessarily hold back. I was a pianist and an instrumentalist first. I was an oboe player. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, my sensibilities of being part of the fabric of the music are so ingrained in me. And so when I'm singing Handel, like I'm just very much devoted to that style. When I'm singing Mozart, I'm very much devoted to my boyfriend Mozart. but, you know, I just feel like as a singer, I am an open relationship kind of person. And I feel like there's room for everyone.
Yes. Ethical repertoire non-monogamy. Yeah. Yeah. We stand. Right. We stand.
Exactly.
That.
Like I'm monogamous with my husband, but that's it. As far as composers go, I play the field.
That's awesome. One of the things that I couldn't help but notice when we look at this sort of career of Weston, don't edit this out, bad is that there is sort of this recurring theme of saying no in a positive way for advocation for you and your career. You know, one of the first times I noticed it is when, you know, you're auditioning for the Opera Foundation and they ask you to sing Queen of the Night and you directly said, that's not on my rep list. And so you just flat out said no. And not a lot of singers maybe would have felt so emboldened as to say that. You know, you just talked about how you and your agent said no to you doing Queen all of the time. You're like, no, I don't want to just be known for the Queen. I want to do all these other things. Even when we get to when you are pregnant and you're supposed to be singing Cunegonda, and the director was like, you know what? No, we're not going to have a pregnant lady running around on platforms. We want to protect you. We want to advocate for you. And then, of course, the thing that I have barked about no less than four times on this show previously is how when DeVelt went ahead and put their head right up their hindquarters and spoke about your appearance as opposed to your actual performance in the DeVelt magazine, you were the first one to say, no, this is unacceptable. This is not okay behavior. And I think it's so interesting that the art of saying no is something that has been really empowering and advocating for you. So, I mean, when I say something like that, when I'm like, saying no seems like a really cool thing for you. Like, what's your response when you hear that?
My response is thank you. I love hearing that about myself. You know, I guess I've always been really a strong-minded person. I was really a very willful child. And as my mom, you know, very often says, my brother was a little easier to raise than you were, but mm-hmm. you were the spice of my life. And, you know, I guess it's not something that I necessarily try to be or try to do. It's just who I am. And it's like, take it or leave it. I definitely, you know, also try to be an easy person to work with. And I'm not just going to, you know, sit here and think only of myself and what's good for me and stuff. But I do definitely find it impossible to let people walk all over me. And I find it impossible to do something that I don't feel is right for my career or right for my personal life. And I guess there's just this force inside of me that makes it, for better or for worse, because sometimes I really struggle with these feelings. It's not necessarily easy for me to say no, but I find it impossible not to when it doesn't feel right.
Yeah, no, this makes a lot of sense. And speaking of people that might potentially walk all over you, you've got two little ones in your house that you have to do a daily exercise of straddling that line. So, you know, when we think about sort of what your parenting style is, or, you know, folks don't have to have a parenting style, but when you think about how that advocacy for you works, and then how it transitions to how it is that you and your partner are raising your children. Let's talk a little bit about that.
And we assume you're monogamous with your children. So
yes. Yes. I only have one son.
You're not parenting other children.
As far as we know.
I'm not raising other people's kids. No. Yeah. I mean, two is enough, and it's hard and it's messy. And that's, you know, when you were talking about the way that I sing Mozart, I kind of love the cleanliness of it, although kind of my greatest joy is to get it a little bit dirty, which feels very Mozartian to me. Like, I can only imagine that he was a little bit raunchy in real life. Not a little bit, like probably a lot. Mm. And so he's this sort of like brilliant, perfect genius who is so rough around the edges. And I love to kind of bring that to my portrayal of Mozart and to Queen. But back to the family thing. Yeah, we don't have a parenting style, although we did read this fantastic book called Bringing Up Bebe, which, it's, you know, it's this woman who wrote this book about raising, she's American. She, raised her kids in France. She married a British guy. So it's like this sort of like, beautiful, family of, you know, different circumstances all kind of being thrown together. And they raised their kids outside of Paris. And they're like, the way that she talks about raising her kids, she says it's a very like French thing. Like, there is no style. It just is the way. Mm. And you know, the idea that you're really a team as a family. And that's really how Zach and I have approached parenting, and it will become more and more a way that we approach parenting now that, like, especially our daughter, who's going to be 4 in October, at the end, well, just a couple weeks. Oh my gosh. And, you know, thinking about how do we work together, because we're not just like living under the same roof. We also have to do these insane things, like in 4 days, we're leaving for 5 months on the road. And we have to work together. We have to be a team, or else traveling and moving from Airbnb to Airbnb to Vrbo to rented apartment to whatever, like all of these different flights and everything, it's never going to work if we can't all be on the same page. And so figuring out like how do we even like present this to our kids? Because it's just such a unique lifestyle comparatively.
We want to stay on the topic of parenting for just a moment. And Ashley has her standard template of questions that she asks mother singers.
Well, we like to bring these topics into conversation because I don't think anybody talks about them enough. And there are lots of people that are navigating this career and all of the changes that happen emotionally, spiritually, physiologically, as your body goes to make another whole body. So I'd like to just talk to you a little bit about first the physiological. You know, talk to me about the difference between what you felt sensationally pre-motherhood and then how you felt making music sensationally post-motherhood.
Yeah, I think that like the experience of being pregnant and then having kids, giving birth as 2 C-sections. You know, as young singers, I think much of what we do is somewhat intuitive. Singing as a beast is something that, you know, like anybody can sing, even if it's terrible, you know, even if it's out of tune and even if it sounds like a herd of dying cats, you're still singing. Like it doesn't matter. You know, I hear from people who say, I love to sing. I'm so terrible at it, but I love to sing and I don't ever want anybody to hear it, but I sing in the shower and I sing in the car and it just feels so good. And that's the thing about singing. Like it just feels good. So it doesn't matter what it sounds like. But for those of us who have gone into singing as a profession, obviously we must be pretty good at it or else like people are not going to hire us to do it. And I think that that's like it's not like I popped out of the womb singing opera, but it certainly for some reason or another, was kind of innately, intuitively a part of me. And of course, you know, I went to Eastman School of Music for 6 years, got 2 degrees, worked with voice teachers over the years to perfect my technique and the functionality of my voice. And so there's always improvements to be made and there's always discoveries to be made and you hone in on certain things, like maybe you have weaknesses here and there and you work on those things. But the fundamental act of singing is just part of you.
Yeah.
And when I was pregnant, it felt a little bit like I was on steroids the entire time, until like the end, you know, where I just felt like somebody blew a balloon up inside of me.
But when you say you felt like you were on steroids, does it mean like things were easy and like,
Okay. Like until the last like month or so, I felt like I didn't have to work hard at all it was like rearranging and stuff. And I kind of I was making lots of discoveries, but that even in and of itself, I was like, wow, this is really cool that even though I've got this person growing inside of me and my body is changing, like not even just every day, but every hour, it felt like I was going through like a new physical change and that my voice could keep up with it. And I could still do the thing, like the thing being reach high Fs, you know, like I could still do it. Even with all of the changes. And that was like really empowering to me as a pregnant person. And of course, by the end, I mean, I was still singing Queen when I was like
almost 8.5 months pregnant. I was at least 8 months pregnant. Speaking of saying no, I was singing at the Paralada Festival in Northern Spain, and it's an outdoor venue. And I think it was like 115 degrees during the day. And at night it would like go down to 106. It was like one of those things, you know? And for any of you who have ever been pregnant, heat is not your friend when you're pregnant. Oh my gosh, it was so uncomfortable. And so they're fitting me in this like long black gown, and they're talking about these sleeves that they're going to put me in and everything. I'm like, yeah, no, this dress is not going to have sleeves. That's a hard no for me.
I cannot believe you were singing in the heat. My goodness. Please continue, but I'm just going to like ruminate on that for a second.
That was like my first pregnancy. And so I wisened up for my second pregnancy because literally nobody knows this because it never came to fruition. But for the first time in my entire career, I hadn't accepted anything except Queens for like part of like the first part of like the fall season 2020 and into 2021. And we all know what happened that season. And that's when I was planning on being pregnant with my son, Charlie. And then everything stopped. And so I ended up doing like a concertized Messiah. And I did one Queen down in Palm Beach. But other than that, like I just did like, cocktail hours with various donors over Zoom and stuff. And I just was like pregnant and fat and happy, for my second pregnancy. So that actually, that was my, COVID. I hate saying silver lining because I think that that's almost feels like a derogatory term when so many people were suffering and dying, but you know, if there was one positive side to the world shutdown for me, it was that I could actually not have to go through, you know, traveling the world and being in front of people while I was pregnant and also postpartum, because that whole thing that happened with Die Welt and Manuel Bruch, that was me at 9 months postpartum. And I was already suffering with postpartum anxiety and depression. And that just kind of, actually, it made me angry. It almost kind of snapped me out of it, but it also kind of sent me into a darker place, which was not a good place to set me up for when the whole shutdown happened with COVID, because I know a lot of people really suffered with that. And I definitely was one of them over the summer. Like during the spring, I was kind of too busy with, like moving out of my apartment and having a very tiny toddler, and we were sort of like living with my parents and then living with Zach's parents, and then we were closing on our house, and then we were doing all sorts of DIY remodeling of our house. And then when all of that slowed down, I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, I'm in a pit of despair. So it's been a journey, definitely, at least for me, and I think for a lot of people in this time.
I want to just circle back to, you know, you've got these two big jobs, you know, you've got musician, you've got mom, and we know the folks at Die Welt weren't necessarily supportive of that. But what I'd like to do is talk about the people that were in fact supportive of you during that time, talking about, you know, companies that have been accommodating, or maybe some that weren't, if we, you know, we don't have to name them. That's okay. But there are companies out there that are willing to work with artists as people and support women as mothers. And it seems like you've experienced a lot of that.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to throw any companies under the bus. I actually had quite a few good experiences. I won't say great, but good experiences. You know, and by good experiences, I mean that most of the companies that I worked for while I was pregnant, they were like, we're so happy you're here, even though you're pregnant, you know, like, despite the fact that you're pregnant, we're happy that you're still doing this job. And I wish that it were a little bit more like, we're so excited that we have the opportunity to have a pregnant person here, because like that is diversity on one level. And that's not exactly what I experienced, but I do know a couple of my friend/colleagues, Aaron Morley and Julie Fuchs. They were both pregnant at the same time that I was, and both of them had some pretty bad experiences. So I feel really fortunate. And again, I won't throw those companies that they were with under the bus, because I don't think that's a kind thing to do, but they're pretty common knowledge within the opera business anyway. It's not hard to dig up those stories. But I feel good that, that I didn't have to at least deal with situations like that. I will say that I have to give a shout out to Francesca Zambello at WNO, because of course I was headed back to WNO to do Cunegonda and there in her Candide, which I had premiered that production at Glimmerglass a couple of years beforehand. Loved the production, loved the experience, couldn't wait to do it again. I was 5 months pregnant. And I'm 5 feet tall, for anybody who doesn't know that tidbit of information. Everybody thinks that I'm very tall.
More diversity. It is. You're a short queen.
Like no one recognizes me when I come off stage, because they all think that I'm like 5'10" or something, and I'm 5 feet tall. But my husband is 6'6". He is a full 18 inches taller than me. And so I carry giant babies in my tiny little body. And so at 5 months pregnant, I looked like some people do at 9 months pregnant. I was like fully popped. And, you know, I was feeling a little concerned just about the way that I looked because of the role, and, you know, the production didn't really allow for that. But the great thing was, is that, you know, Francesca kept saying to me, I want you to know that it has nothing to do with the fact that you look like a pregnant Cunegonda, because we could work that in. We could totally work this. But you know what the set is like. You know what this show is. And she just was really concerned for my safety. And I have to say that I kind of fought it at first, because I just was so excited to revisit that production. And then, you know, we had a really good conversation about it. And, the other person who was advocating for me, even when I wasn't, was Denise Graves. She was, right there, you know, in rehearsals and seeing what I was doing. And, after I finally did pull out of the production, by the way, treated really well. Francesca was like, I'm going to pay your entire contract. Like, no questions asked. I'm just going to pay your entire contract. You go and enjoy these 6 weeks that you would have been working here. Rest, enjoy yourself, do some yoga, you know, just take care of yourself. And after I did finally pull out of the production, I left pretty abruptly. Didn't go back to any more rehearsals, because like why go back? And Denise actually called my cell phone, somehow, you know, got my cell phone number, called my cell phone, and left this lovely message saying, you know, I was in a position once just like you, and I wish that I had made the decision that you have made. And that's all she said, but man, that support and like hearing that affirmation for the decision that I made really, really touched me.
Well, I want to say that Emily Pogorelz, who stepped in for you, is a friend of the show, and I didn't know the other side of the story. So it's actually great to connect those dots and to have the other side, which is, I knew that Francesca Zambello was an incredible intendant, but That's awesome. And Denise Graves, we want her on the show too. So we stand. Yeah. Let's take a pause right now and just enjoy a little bit of your brand new album with Il Pomodoro. This is the accompagnato from one of my favorite cantatas, Armida Abbandonata. Entro la neve. Se So everybody knows how much I love Handel, and I am crazy about this album. Armida Abandonata is one of my favorite cantatas, and A Crudel is like my personal anthem. But when I was listening to this album, I was just, I had that same reluctance that I did years ago when I went to go hear your Mass in C minor, that, okay, here is an opera singer. Can she bring it down to sing this intimate cantata? And the answer is actually yes and no. You do bring your voice down and you do the most elegant, you know, instrumental flights of coloratura, and you lay off the vibrato and you lean into dissonances, all the stuff that us early music people are looking for. But just like in that moment, in that accompagnato, you're like, you know what? This is opera, actually. So here's some drama for you, you know? And it makes it so
exciting. It makes it so dramatic with it.
I love Handel. But I mean, you know, there's this weird, I think we're in a really cool time for Handel singing, because we are deciding.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to get so geeky with you here.
Okay, let's do it. Yeah, Go for it.
Oh shoot. My God. I could not agree with you more with this time being like extra special for Handel. And I'll start out by saying, randomly, my husband and I were given an antique book. I mean, it's not like a new book or anything. It was written in the 1950s, and it's like an opera book, you know, like about composers and about styles and genres of opera. And actually, maybe it's just like all about classical music. And the part about Handel is like, it talks all about his oratorios and stuff. And then like the last sentence, it says something like, oh, and by the way, he also wrote some operas, but they've all been forgotten in the repertory. Like they don't exist, you know? And it's so funny, because now it's like, I feel like half of my career has been Handel. And I'm like, this book could not be more wrong. It just was like, it was going through a little hiatus during that time. Yeah. And it wasn't popular, and that's okay. But here's the thing. Like, I really honestly think that the equivalent to what Handel is to this time period is sort of like what the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s to some extent was to bel canto. Mm-hmm. You know, all the great singers of that time, Maria Callas, Beverly Caballé, Silk,
yeah.
Caballé, Pavarotti,
Shirley Verrett.
I mean, all of them, they like brought Sutherland, you know, they all brought bel canto to a new level. And the cadenzas that they wrote and started singing or had written for them, you know, like some of them didn't write them, but they were all theirs. Mm-hmm. And we're still singing them. You know, like you can hardly improve on that. Like I wrote my own cadenza for my debut singing Lucia. And it's like, I love it only because it calls, like I borrowed things from the Stills and I borrowed things from the Sutherland. And then I brought in like echoes of other parts of the opera that I really like. And I just got creative with it, but it's special to me, but like nobody else is going to think it's better than what they sang, you know, because like you can't improve upon what they did. But in Handel, we have a unique opportunity here as singers, those of us who sing early music, because there isn't any standard like repertory of cadenzas or ornaments. And I have always had like such joy and taken such pride in writing my own ornaments and cadenzas. And I feel like if we do it right, the singers of today who are singing Handel, people in another 50 years are going to be singing our cadenzas that we wrote now for Handel, because like all this Handel repertoire is really coming into its own right now.
Well, let's also acknowledge that you made this album with one of the sexiest bands that's recording right now, Il Pomodoro.
Right? They are so awesome.
Yeah. It's such a cool band. And they really make a meal out of all of the moments. And the continuo is always sounding so fresh. And they get a little aggressive on their downbeats. And it feels like, ugh.
Yeah, like, it gets dirty, right?
Yeah,
it gets
exactly. Dirty. Yeah,
but
and
it's
this one
such a good way. Yeah, and speaking of sexy, like the whole circumstance of recording this was the sexiest thing. We were all like living at this monastery in northern Italy, and the whole building was shrouded in fog basically the entire time we were there.
And so it was a little bit like a scene from The Others with Nicole Kidman. Yeah. And my husband and my daughter are like, you know, wandering around the dark, abandoned hallways of this monastery. And we're recording this incredibly spooky and ethereal and dramatic music. It was really kind of perfect.
Well, the recording is Armida Abbandonata and the Apollo e Daphne duet cantata with Il Pomodoro on the Pentatone label. You can listen to it on Spotify and other places. And you hinted at the fact that you have a husband who's a singer. So we want to talk really briefly about an opportunity to hear both of you in concert for a good cause.
Yeah. Foodoflove.org, or go to either of our social media platforms, Instagram or Facebook. We're primarily raising money through Facebook and Instagram because all of the credit card fees are waived. So it's a great bang for your buck. But you can also donate directly. We recorded a concert last May at a beautiful art museum called the Michener in Doylestown, PA, which is where my husband was raised. And we just did like favorite things. You know, we kind of like threw this thing together because we were both really distraught about what was happening in Ukraine. And at the time, we were sort of thinking, okay, we're going to do this for the refugees. But then we started just at that time, it was like the news was starting to turn about like what the war was doing to the rest of the world, and specifically like at that time it was the Horn of Africa that was like really missing out on a lot of grain imports. And so the threat of starvation worldwide has since then escalated to insane heights. And so we decided to make, once we were putting this on film and thinking about streaming, we decided to benefit the UN World Food Program. So please download it and please donate whatever you can.
You said a little bit earlier that you're about to go 5 months with your kids in tow I know you're coming to Chicago to sing your Countess Adele in Contori with Larry Brownlee. I'm very excited to hear you sing En Poix la Tristesse, one of my favorite all-time arias. And then to get into a three-way with Larry Brownlee and Kaylee Decker. And we know that you're not monogamous, so that's going to be great for your relationship. But what we know that your season, this five-month stretch you're about to do, ends with the new magic flute that they're building for Larry to sing Tamino in. So it's like,
yeah, it's like starting a Larry and Katie, a Larry and Katie season.
Yeah. What do you have in between Queens?
Yeah. So I'm super excited about this, this Contori in Chicago. I've really been looking forward to it. And it's not just Larry that I'm excited to work with. I mean, the rest of the cast as well, but, super excited to work again with Enrique Mazzola. Because we did Orfeo's Enfer in the Salzburg Festival, which is out on DVD.
Was it
hilarious for any
Orfeo? Was it the Manuel Brug Orfeo?
Yes, it was that one. Indeed. I know. Yeah, and so like we'll do that, and then it's like my kids will be with me and my husband will be with me the entire time. My parents are even joining our travels for some of the time. So it's a big family event. And so then we all go to Berlin, and I will make a trip down to Dresden to make my debut singing queen at the Semperoper. And then back to Berlin to finally do the four heroines in Tales of Hoffmann. And the reason I say finally is because I was actually supposed to premiere that production at Deutsche Oper in 2018, but instead I had my first baby. So it was a pretty good reason to cancel.
Yeah.
But I'm so happy that Christoph Seufele has invited me back to finally do that production, because I feel like doing all of those heroines is like going to be the most fulfilling challenge of my career thus far.
Very jealous for everybody who gets to hear this four heroines. It's one of my favorite operas of all time. You do all the music that I want to hear. So okay. So now then I hear London, Nice, and Antwerp.
Yeah, and then London. I'm making my also finally I'm making my Covent Garden debut, Singing Queen, which I had to cancel last season because I had my second baby. So all of these debuts that were supposed to happen are finally kind of coming back to me this season, which is fun. And then I'll go to Nice and sing a Lucia, and I'm really looking forward to spending some time in the south of France in the early spring, because there's just nothing better than that, weather-wise, climate-wise. And then I just added to my season, I don't even think that I've advertised this yet, but I just added a recital in Antwerp in Belgium, where I'm going to sing some Poulenc, and I think, so it's not official, but you guys are hearing it first, I think for the first time I'm going to learn Strauss's Four Last Songs.
Oh, wow.
So
you heard it here first, Belgians. Yep. Very exciting.
You did. Yeah, and then a couple more queens in Dresden, and then finally home for a few weeks before I start rehearsals at the Met for their new production, I put in quotations because I've done it twice already, the McBurney in France. Once when I was, the first time that I did it in 2014, that was the recording that you played at the very beginning. And that was my first experience with that production and with Simon himself, who he is a interesting mind. And I think that the production is really cool. I mean, it's like a psychological thriller. And I really recommend it. But what I don't recommend is bringing your kids. Mm. And I say mm-hmm. that because the production, the Julie Taymor that's at the Met right now, is so kid friendly. Mm-hmm. And Peter Galb actually called my dressing room before one of our performances last season and, told me toy, toy, toy for my performance and stuff. And he mentioned that he was excited that I was going to be back to do the new production next season. And I said, yeah, so listen, I'm familiar with it, like very, very familiar with it. And I feel a little bit like you need to put a disclaimer out, like in the New York Times or something, saying that this is a totally different beast than the Julie Taymor.
Yeah.
He's no. like, okay, noted, duly noted. Thank you.
They've been billing that as like the family show. So be careful. Right. So good warning. Right.
Exactly. The second time that I did that production, I was... I was like 7.5 months pregnant with my daughter. So I was actually a little grateful for the wheelchair at that point.
Yeah, because you're like an old lady in that one, right? Like, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The whole second aria, I'm okay. like tearing around, ripping up the stage in a wheelchair.
Well, Catherine Lewick, it's been so great to meet you this way. And I'm so looking forward. We're both looking forward to hearing you in the Contori coming up in Chicago. Thank you for being on Opera Box Score.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Anytime, guys.
Inside the Huddle with Catherine Lewick, just before Halloween in 2022. Before that, the end of August of that same year, 2022, Oliver kicked off a brand new short form segment called Free Throw. This is the season 7 finale, yikes. And who better than to kick off that brand new segment than mezzo-soprano Isabel Leonard.
Free Throw!
Speaking of Santa Fe, we have one more interview to share from this year's festival. Oliver interviewed Isabel Leonard for his other job, but got her permission to share these outtakes from their chat. Even though Isabel was starring in her second ever production of Carmen at Santa Fe, Oliver wanted to talk about a memorable production which came earlier in her career, Klaus Guth's take on Cozy from the Salzburg Festival. We will link to the video in the show notes. Let's hear a bit of that performance from 2009.
did this production of Cozy where you had to stand, I don't know, 20 feet above the stage on, I don't know how much of a platform you had. If it was like 2 feet of, I was terrified. When I was watching, I was like, oh my God, I'm so nervous for you right now.
Yeah. I don't think I could do that again now. I feel like I've developed a little bit of vertigo as I've gotten older. So, but yeah, at the time it was as scary as it looked.
Yeah. What was the fail safe for you? Was there anything? No. Was there a soft ground?
No, there was no fail safe. The only thing I did was I'm kind of an ex-dancer in the sense that I studied dance for a really long time and I have a sense of my body and everything. So, you know, I won't put myself into situations that I don't feel like I could control. So in the motion, because, you know, things look pretty flat, especially that stage was so white and everything, and the videos are going to look quite flat. Like I never threw my body forward. Like, so the moment where it looks like I'm going forward, like I actually threw my body backwards, but I brought my arms forward. So it gave a little bit more of an impression. And I had asked them actually, because I would stand on this thing, and I asked them to put double-sided sticky tape, like a thick thing of sticky tape right on the edge of it, so that I could get my toes up there so that I could at least have like some traction. So yeah, it was a pretty crazy thing.
You were like 25 or something like that when you did that.
Yeah. I mean, it was my first Dorabella. Yeah. And I was like, what, 26 or 27 or something. Yeah.
You were saying yes to things.
Yeah. I mean, the crazy thing about all of that is that I most likely offered it, you know, knowing me, I most likely offered it. So, yeah.
I mean, early in your career, when everybody was talking about this new mezzo, like you were talking a lot about fitness and, I don't know if that is like still your brand or if that's like something that a publicist wanted you to do, or I know that you're very fit, you know, but I don't know if that's something that like, you don't want people to talk about that anymore. It's like,
it's not so much like that I don't want people to talk about it anymore. It's just that I also know that there's like I don't know how to describe it, but it's like, I dislike watching people take advantage of things when they're just in fashion, you know? Mm-hmm. It's for me, it's like, it has to just be the honest thing that's happening in the moment. Right. And that particular time, like I was extremely active, of course, physically in the beginning of my career, because I was not a mom yet, you know, and I had always come from dance. And so it was always a big part of my stage craft and presence. Mm-hmm. And then after my son was born, you know, I knew I had to get back to a certain level of fitness because it was the level of fitness that I had learned to sing from. So if my body was in a different place, I was going to be dealing with a completely different instrument, essentially. And even now, like my body is still not the same as it was, obviously, when I was like 28 pre my son. Mm-hmm. But as far as strength goes and the things that I know that I need for singing, you know, those are always things that I'm aware of, you know, and active, you know, being active and being flexible physically and being able to do certain things, you know, like I always say, like, I'll program ketubinos in until I really can't do them anymore. Like until my knees really give out, because it's sort of like, if I say, oh, I've got a ketubino coming up in 6 months, I'm like, oh, I gotta go to the gym, you know, gotta like practice getting up and down from the floor without being like, oh, you know, but you feel the passage of time. Like the ketubino I did at the Met when we opened that new production in 2014, right? I created that one with Richard Eyre because he directed. That's the one you were talking about.
Yeah, the Downton Abbey.
Yeah, exactly. And I had done it so many times by then that I really had a concept of like who he was and what I could and couldn't do. And Richard, I love Richard because he's such a positive enabler for acting. And so all of the staging essentially was like me being like, hey, can I run up that ladder? And then can I slide down it and then like hide under the bed? And like, can we, you know, he was like, just do it, just do whatever. And we'll just tell you. Yeah. So all of that stuff was me running around and like all of it. And then,
but your son was born by then, right?
Oh yeah. He was 4 at that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
So there was also a different level. Like I was more
you know, I was, especially when he was four, because it was like running around a toddler.
Yeah,
you know?
That's exactly my point. I mean, first of all, I just want to tell you that I'm as gay as the day is long. So I can say this hopefully and you'll feel safe. But I was very confused watching you. I had feelings because, like, I've always thought you were a beautiful woman, but like to see you as such a handsome boy, I was like, this is very confusing for me.
I love that. But that's really fun though, actually, you know, because it's like, what's happening? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, as far as like the passage of time goes, so when I did that one again recently, and I had done it before or in between 14 and now, although I can't remember, when I went to do it again now and I stepped in at the last minute in January, February, or whenever that was, of course I kind of remembered all of the staging and all of the things, right? But I remember like going, wow, I don't remember this space under the bed being so small, you know, or like, geez, the run around the stage is really far, you know, like some of the things I was like, yeah, okay. I feel old. My knees are hurting.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but you are just as incredible as I thought you would be. You're so, like, on so many levels, such an admirable artist. And I want to just tell you, thank you for your career and what you've been doing for opera. You are an incredible ambassador for what I love, you know, and when people go see opera and they see, it's like, oh, how come everybody can't be like her, you know?
Oh, that's very nice of you.
Yeah. Your Zerlina in Chicago. I forget when it was.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was a baby.
That was, for me, it's like, holy shit. We have somebody who actually like can be a Zerlina convincingly.
Oh, I know. Well, I can tell you, she and Dorabella took a lot of thought process.
Yeah.
Because I really did not like them at first.
Hmm.
You know, I was very much like, who are these people? You know, because there is that level, they come across sometimes as floozies, depending on how you play them. And so after a while I said, you know what? Forget it. They're not floozies. And I can't play them that way because I have to feel as them, mm-hmm. that the decisions they're making are correct decisions, right? So I was able to find like the route, but it took me a while to kind of like mentally get through with each of them, like the why they do what they do.
So did you rationalize that Zerlina is trying to ascend class-wise rather than?
It wasn't so much that she was trying to ascend class-wise, is that she was, because I think the reason those characters are hard is also because it's very hard as a modern day female to understand the constraints, the stresses, and the inflexibility of the time that those women were living in. The fact that they did not have really choices, like the choices that she had was to marry Mazzetto or go to a convent.
Yeah.
Right. So all of a sudden she has this third choice, which was could, if it were a real choice, would put her in a position to probably take care of her family. You know, who knows? We don't know the rest of the story. So you just build things in to make decisions make sense to yourself. So for me, it was like she was lost in this possibility. And I think that if we really think about people and humans, very few people would just immediately discard something like that if it came their way, whether it was a career opportunity, a life opportunity.
You have to investigate it, you know?
People investigate it. They just do. It's human nature, I think, to want to be in a better, safer position, right? Hmm. And I think if you think of it that way, and you think of her as a woman at that time, being in a safer position, you know, money and stuff like that would have been a safer position for her, right?
Yeah.
So that's what it was. But I think that's why when she is apologizing to him and all of these things, she's very genuine. I think she's very genuine about it. Like, she's also a flirt, but that doesn't make her a bad person, yeah. Right? And I think she also comes to the realization, of course, she loves Mazzetto. I mean, there's no question, you know, and that ends up being for her, you know, and it's sort of the same with Dorabella in a way where somebody else comes into the picture. And if you really take it for face value, and if she really takes for face value that those guys have gone off to war, and what are the odds that they're coming back? I mean, really, for them, the odds are really low.
Yeah.
So maybe her mourning period is a lot faster than Fiordaliche's.
Yeah.
And then she's trying to move on, you know, you never know. So I think that's how I go through it. Because also playing disingenuous, unless the character is truly, that's the character. I don't know. It doesn't come across very nice. I don't think it's not as interesting. So
But we've all seen Zerlina stagings where it's just about sex, you know? Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, oh, come on. This is, there's more to the character than this, you know? She's not just like a horny bluesy.
No. Also, again, I think that just, yeah, it just makes it sort of boring.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and also like, why would he pursue her? You know, why would Don Giovanni pursue? I mean, he pursues all the women, right? But
yeah.
I would like to also suspect, to make his character more interesting, he enjoys the chase, right? He enjoys the challenge, clearly. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone for Elvira, you know? He enjoys the challenge. So I think if Zerlina were just simply like, you know, rolled over, like, that's not very exciting.
Thanks to all three of those fantastic guests helping us kick off Women's History Month. I've been gone from the show for a while. So grateful to the rest of my fabulous crew for making better shows than I ever could have done by myself. Grateful to them. As always, I've been directing a production of Kurt Weill's American Opera Street Scene. And I want to put out this challenge to you. I would argue, from a director's point of view, Street Scene has to be one of the hardest shows in the repertoire. Okay, so maybe Act Two of La Boheme. If you know Boheme well, Act Two is the Café Momus scene, when you've got like children coming in and people buying presents and people selling chestnuts. You get the aria Quando Menvo, which is in the cafe itself. There are so many people on that stage. It's a nightmare to put up on its feet as a director. Street Scene is a pretty close second. A cast of 40 plus roles, a full orchestra. The show clocks in well over 2.5 hours. It's a slice of life piece of American realism, which is problematic in its own dated way with misogyny and racism. I want to know what you think, especially directors out there. What is the hardest piece in the repertoire to stage? You can let us know, operaboxscore@gmail.com.
Good call, bad call on Opera Box Score.
That's it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about opera. Again, make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get your voice heard and find links to stuff we've talked about at our website. It's operaboxscore.com. And hey, that's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. You can give back to the OBS using that Support the Team tab. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant's Oliver Camacho. Your audio editor is Weston Williams. Our co-hosts, Matt Cummings and Ashley Hardgrave. For our guests, Francesca Zambello, Catherine Lewick, and Isabel Leonard, I'm George Cedarquist, asking you to continue the conversation about opera, but don't let a month go by like I did before getting your voice heard. We are back with an all-new show next week. You're going to get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more March Madness. Join us.